now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. As the soft-spoken, highly intelligent son of missionaries in Morganton, North Carolina, Luke Chang gave no indication of the killer he would become, but after hacking into a teacher's computer at his school, a stint in the Marines was his only option. As a young recruit, Luke was taunted for being a virgin who didn't cuss, drink, or smoke pot. That all changed when Luke met Casey Byrams, a fun-loving musician and fellow Marine from Cullman, Alabama. Their friendship set off a series of events that would eventually lead Luke to Pendleton, Oregon, where he brutally murdered 19-year-old Amy Jane Branhagen in August 2012. When Luke attempted to kill another woman almost a year later, Pendleton police knew they had a serial killer wannabe on their hands. Some 40 years prior to Amy Jane's murder, Luke's maternal grandfather, Gene Dale Lincoln, murdered a young Michigan woman and attempted to abduct a 12-year-old girl. The similarities between the violent actions of grandfather and grandson compels the question, is there such a thing as a murder gene? The book that we're featuring this evening is The Murder Gene, A True Story, with my special guest journalist and author, Karen Spears Zacharias. Welcome to the program and thank you very much for this interview, Karen Zacharias.
Thank you, Dan. It's good to be with you again.
Thank you so much for joining us for this incredible tale. First off, tell us how you came to be involved in this story and tell us a little bit about your meeting with Police Chief Stuart Roberts.
Well, I was at one point a reporter on the crime beat in Pendleton, Oregon, where the murder took place. And over the years of my crime reporting, had developed relationships with several of the law enforcement people in the community. Stuart Roberts was chief of the Pendleton Police and very well respected. I had worked with Chief Roberts on my previous crime book, A Silence of Mockingbird, about the death of three-year-old Carly Sheehan. When Amy Jane Branhagen was murdered in August 2012, I actually knew Amy Jane, knew her family very well. My daughter had babysat Amy Jane when she was younger. And So much like the Carly Sheehan, I had this connection to the victim. I called up Chief Roberts and asked if we could meet for coffee shortly after Amy Jane's murder. So we did. And I, at that time, no arrests had been made and very little details about the murder had been released. And when I questioned Stuart as to whether there was a story in all of this, he told me then in 2012 that, yes, there was a story. And he feared that what they had on their hands was a serial killer because of the locale of Pendleton. It's located right along the Interstate 84 that runs between Boise, Idaho, and Portland, Oregon. And it would be very easy for someone to jump off that interstate, do a crime. In Amy's case, it was the middle of the afternoon on a bright, sunny August day, and the killer had walked away completely unseen.
Now, part of the research for this book is that we call it the murder gene, and you did some extensive research from all the latest experts doing this research, conducting this research. Tell us basically the research that you delved into regarding DNA.
Well, what happened when I began researching the story of Luke Chang, the killer, I found out that his grandfather was in prison, had been in prison at one point, and I didn't know why that was, why he would have been. So I had gone back to Chief Roberts and said, what was Luke's grandfather in prison for? And Chief Roberts didn't even know at that point that he had been. I had just come across it in a brief note in pages and pages of documents. And then he came back and told me that he had been arrested and put in prison for murder. So I began collecting the information on Luke's grandfather. And that immediately led me to think, what an oddity that was to have a grandfather and a grandson both committing pretty violent murders of women neither one of them knew or had any connection to. I was immediately drawn to the fact that there might be a genetic connection to that kind of violence. And so I'm not a scientist, not an expert in DNA. I began researching, and of course, it took me 10 years of research. DNA is, as you well know, changing hour by hour, the yes. discoveries that we are making in DNA. And the first person I got a hold of was specialist at Florida State University, Dr. Kevin Bacon. And he explained to me that it is an uncomfortable subject for us to talk about, that there might be a connection of violence in families, that we prefer to think of that as all environmental. But the way the doctor explained it to me was that it's very much like if you, say, have a grandfather who has diabetes, you won't necessarily get diabetes, but you will have a propensity toward diabetes.
Right.
And it's the same with violence. It doesn't mean if your grandfather is a serial killer that you're going to be a serial killer, but you have a higher propensity for aggression and violence, as significantly higher, according to Dr. Bacon and others that I interviewed.
And many people call this MAOA gene, the warrior gene, but you say other people regard this or refer to this as the psychogene.
Well, it's called some people call it the psychogene. It is really an enzyme within the gene. It's the moxomain oxidase A. And for it to be a warrior gene that is most commonly referred to, it has a 2R variant, meaning it repeats twice or more. It is carried. We all have it. But in women, it doesn't show up as commonly because women have two of the, it comes on the X chromosome. Women have two. So if I were to have it, one of the X chromosomes may cancel it out in me. But it is carried through the mother's line and passed. Like I said, all of us have the MAOA gene, but we don't all have the 2R variant, and we see it most commonly in men. It's highly valued and referred to as a warrior gene because it makes men more aggressive, more willing on the battlefield, that kind of thing. Is the light it has been up until this point put into a very positive light as being that thing you want your warriors to have. Well, it would be really interesting to know how many of these white supremacists we're dealing with in these mass shootings are dealing with that 2R variant right now.
You talk about this 2R variant, but it's also called a mutation.
Yes, it is a mutation. And these, just like with arthritis or diabetes or breast cancer, these are, and there is a inheritability to that variant. But the having that variant alone isn't enough. It is a marker on the gene, and how that marker responds to the environmental factors, just as with other inheritable factors just as with diabetes, lifestyle would be a factor that would come into play as to whether the diabetes became full blown or not. Same thing with this mutant enzyme or marker on the gene is influenced by those environmental factors.
You pose the question, though, is it possible that grandfather and grandson shared a code for murder? Let's talk about Gene Dale Lincoln and what you did find out about his crimes. And you take us to Nancy Ellen Laws, and she's camping at Michigan's King Lake. Tell us what happens when she meets Gene and how she meets Gene Dale Lincoln.
So in the week prior to Gene meeting with Nancy, he was a father of four kids and married at the time and had even been at one point the tax assessor in his county. I mean, he was employed in a machine company at the point of Nancy's death. But he was someone you would consider well-established. He had a job. He had been in the military, although he had been discharged, I think, dishonorably. I have those records, but right. He was discharged from the Army for unknown reasons. Anyway, he had a variety of jobs and seemed like the kind of guy who would live next door to you. But he and his wife got into a huge fight and he left their home, left the kids and went to see a friend and did, you know, just explain that they'd had a disagreement and he drank. And so did she. And I think the alcohol certainly was a contributing factor and probably their fighting and their resulting imprisonment. But after staying with a friend, he then went off and went camping at King's Lake. It's a popular campsite. Our, you know, recreation site did not have a lot of campsites. Nancy Laws grew up in Waukesha and was very well known in Waukesha. She was a college co-ed, attractive. She had a great voice, was a singer and an artist. And it was getting to be break time for her. And she had made arrangements to meet some friends. And she had this hobby where she liked to go and visit what we consider ghost towns. We have a couple of those in our area in Oregon. You probably have some too. Old settled areas where the housings and things still remain, but nobody's particularly living in them. So she had left Waukesha. She had packed up to go camping and she went up and she had gotten to the campsite later than she had planned and was setting up her campsite when Gene came over and introduced himself and offered to help her. There were only 10 campsites. There were some people out fishing, but it was getting on towards dark. They got her tent set up. He had offered her a beer and they had been talking. At some point in the evening, he made a pass at her. She had thought he was married because he had a wedding ring on. So she didn't realize he was out there camping alone. I'm not sure she would have pitched her tent there had she known. But he made a pass at her. She rejected him. He ended up killing her violently and then sexually assaulting her after she was dead. Put her body in the trunk of his car, drove it around for a day, and disposed of it very far away from the campsite.
Now, not long after, there is this Donnie and her friend Pam, and they want to go camping as well. So what happens in the interim in terms of police looking for this killer, about this crime? Tell us what happens after that, after Nancy Law's disappearance, and how many days it is till Donnie and Pam decide to go camping and bump into Gene Lincoln?
Well, there were actually months that had passed before that encounter happens. Gene Lincoln did not go back home after the murder of Nancy Laws. He hit her car and, you know, began hitchhiking around and going from campsite to campsite. In Donnie's case, Donnie lived at the lake and in a different county. And she was a young teen girl, beautiful. And she and her friend, I mean, you know, when you live at the lake is your backyard. Mm-hmm. It's just your lifestyle. She knew the area very, very well. And like a lot of teenagers, she was spending her summer at the lake. She had gotten permission to spend the night with her girlfriend, Pam, who also lived up at the lake. But they were actually spending the night at Pam's house, like Donnie's parents thought she was. They had made arrangements with a friend to stay at his campsite. He was gone, so they were just going to use his tent and stay at their his campsite that night. And that is what they did. And at some point, this was a very crowded campsite, by the way. There are lots of people there. Mm-hmm. A lot of people lived at the lake year-round. And in this case, they had asked the man at the campsite near them to help them with a problem they were having with their kerosene lamp, or not their kerosene, but their camp lamp. And he had helped, and they were kind of repulsed by this guy who was obviously not clean and kind of scary and all of that. But at some point, they went to bed, and the next morning, early before daybreak, they had heard a noise outside their tent, and Donnie got up to see what it was. And at that point, Gene Lincoln grabbed her and began the process of an abduction. She was 12 at the time, but Donnie, you know, was a 12 going on 18, right? Mm-hmm. So very attractive. And because she was at the lake all the time, very athletic. And she was able, through, she believes, the intervention of God, and I believe the strength of her sheer will, to make an escape. Had she not made the escape, he would have killed her. But she escaped the abduction and then began an all-out pursuit for this man. I don't know that they had initially put his connection to Nancy Laws together, but they, because it was different jurisdictions, there was Waukesha, Kingsleigh, Newaygo, Borrego. There were different counties in different jurisdictions all working on these two cases. But at some point, the police were law enforcement, I think it was the state police actually, who picked him up for hitchhiking. He was charged initially with the abduction of Donnie, but eventually, of course, was charged with the murder of Nancy Laws.
You talk about his friend Bill Olson, that he initially, after he broke up with his wife, he went and Bill offered him a place at his home. And what he had brought along was a big trunk, you say.
Right.
And so he left that trunk behind, suspiciously, Bill thought, his friend thought. And when he had heard about the abduction about Donnie, he decided to open that trunk and then call police. So what did he find in that trunk? And that call to police helped police put this together, didn't it?
Yes, that call definitely did. And that trunk had been at Bill's for quite some time before. You know, it was his friend. I suppose most of us would never suspect our friends as being serial killers or, you know, a murderer of any sort. Remember interviewing Ann Rule once about her connection, you know, to Ted Bundy, mm-hmm. and how surprised she was that this was someone she knew. And certainly that was the case with Bill. He had no idea. He knew his friend had a volatile temper. He knew he drank too much, but then so did Bill.
Sure.
So it was just his drinking buddy. Anyway, it wasn't until after the young girl was abducted. And I suspect, although I don't know this for sure, but I suspect what must have come to Bill's mind was the timeline of things, you know, that Gene would have come to see him after the fight with Doris, his wife, and then a girl ends up murdered. And then Gene comes to see him again, leaves his trunk, and a child is abducted, you know, these kind of things, the timeline began to seem suspicious to Bill. He had not opened the trunk, but after the abduction of Donnie, he did go and open the trunk, and in it was a shoebox. And in that shoebox had been the shoes Nancy Law's mother had bought her.
Right.
And it was really when he called police and said, there was women's clothing in this, which he knew not to be Jean Dell's wife.
Sure.
Because it was teenager, young girl, co-ed kind of clothing, couple sketchbooks, some identification kind of things, not driver's license, but, just things that would not have belonged to Mrs. Lincoln. And so at that point, he called police. And it was when the police showed the shoebox to Nancy's mother that they positively identified the belongings as belonging to Nancy.
You write that the county prosecutor, Springstead, part of the investigation, he begins a investigation into the disappearance of Nancy Laws. And so in this, they find the car, and you talk about this incredible deal that is offered him through his attorneys, through the prosecutor Mather. So this is a fascinating, this is unique. I mean, a lot of books about, I've never seen this. So anyway, please tell us about what happens and this incredible offer and why.
Well, they did find Nancy Law's car, but they had not found her body. And as the case in a lot of murder situations like this, where the body is not found, prosecutors will often offer a deal to the suspects because they want to be able to return that body to the family. And sometimes those deals, I think oftentimes those families feel, yes, they want the bodies, but they don't like the deals being made because it often feels like these people are not going to be held accountable for the great wrongs they have done. And what happened in this particular case is that the prosecutor had offered Jean Lincoln a deal to find out where Nancy's body was, but he had not done that with the court's approval. The judge had not agreed to this ahead of time. There was been no discussion, so he's just offering this on his own to get to that body. And Jean does reveal where Nancy's body is at, but then the judge is furious over the deal that has been cut, and he rejects it because the deal was to charge Jean with the abduction of Donnie, but to let him off lightly on the murder of Nancy, which had been extremely violent.
Yes.
As I point out, he sexually assaulted her after she was murdered.
Yes.
He probably assaulted her before she was murdered, but he didn't want to say that. He didn't really want to say that he had assaulted her after she was murdered either, but he said he couldn't remember. But in this case, the judge threw it out and said, no, we're not going to cut that deal because this is too light of a sentence. It was 10 years for an extremely heinous act. And so the judge and the attorneys got into it in the courtroom, and the judge just rejected it. Well, that put the attorney in the bad situation with the Jean, who had already told them where the body was at. So what happens is the attorney then gets it moved to a different judge who then does approve it.
So incredibly, he keeps this deal, honors this deal, and so Jean Lincoln is sent to prison. You write,
for only 10 years.
Yes, you're right. For the minimum of 10 years. He had a maximum of 15 and a minimum of 10, I believe. And he's released in 10.
Right.
Interestingly, who welcomes him into their home? after he is released?
Well, that was shocking to me, actually. It was Luke's sister, Leia, who explained to me that her grandfather came to live with the family in North Morganton, North Carolina, after he's released from prison. Now, when I interviewed Leia, she maintained that nobody in the family, she and Luke, didn't know what their grandfather was in prison for. In fact, didn't even know they had a grandfather until he showed up. According to Leia, the only grandparents she had any contact with had been her grandmother's. She could only remember seeing Doris one or two times. Apparently, she was quite an alcoholic, and it was Leia's mom, Heidi, who became the primary, you know, maternal figure in the household, having to do a lot and take care of a lot of things. And their lives were completely disrupted, as you can imagine, with any situation where head of a household is imprisoned. So Leia said she didn't know she had any grandfathers. Her contact with her paternal grandmother was limited because her paternal grandmother was a Hmong refugee from South Vietnam and did not speak English, and Leia did not speak Hmong or Vietnamese. So whatever contact she had with that particular grandmother was very limited. Leia's father, Jay, had moved the family to Morganton, North Carolina from Illinois, where his family had immigrated to following the Vietnam War. And he and Heidi had gone to Morganton initially. Jay was called to be the pastor there at the Hmong Baptist Church there in Morganton. For whatever reason that nobody would talk about, including the church folks, he did not last in that job for more than a year and began working instead at one of the many furniture factories there in foothills of Appalachia. And so all of a sudden, you know, when Leia's about 4 or 5 years old, her grandfather shows up out of nowhere, arrives on a bus, and her mom and family, they just go and welcome him like you would any long lost relative you hadn't seen in a dozen years. And he comes and lives at Leia with the Cheng family there for a while until he gets out on his own. There's never any mention of why there had been no contact. And if you take Leia's story at face value, she claimed, even during our many, many interviews, that she nor Luke knew why their grandfather had ever been in prison.
Yeah, so let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. Certain people just make my life so much easier. I don't know what I'd do without them. Like my wife, Lisa, who stays very quiet while I prepare for interviews. And like Evan, my engineer, who takes care of all the technical issues so I can focus on the interview for each episode. It's like if you own a growing business and need to hire, ZipRecruiter makes hiring so much easier because they do the work for you. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. You can easily review these recommended candidates, invite your top choices to apply. Additionally, ZipRecruiter has a complete suite of tools that makes it easy to filter, review, and rate your candidates. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site, based on G2 satisfaction ratings as of January 1st, 2022. In fact, the hardest thing you have to do to remember our special URL, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's where you go to try ZipRecruiter for free. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, we just introduced that the grandfather, Gene Lincoln, came to live with Leah and Luke, Luke being six years old, and Leah, his sister, being 4 years old. Tell us, as you write in the book, a little bit about their life living with their parents and what that consisted of. You talk about poverty, but you talk about them, their parents being missionaries. Tell us about life growing up.
So Jay and Heidi met at a church in the Jack Hiles Church up in Indiana area. And Jack Hiles ran one of the biggest, what we would consider today, a mega church. And it ran this huge bus ministry that went around collecting kids from neighborhoods all throughout the area. So they had met there, and their marriage had been bonded in a large degree by the shared values they had as evangelical Christians. And Jay had long felt the call to be a pastor and missionary to return to the countries and to the peoples that he had grown up with prior to his dad's death during the Vietnam War. So they took that call and came to Morganton. North Carolina had a huge Hmong refugee community during that time. That it was a large settlement, and you can see why there's a lot of similarities geographically, culturally, to the kind of community that Jay was familiar with. So they moved there, but like I said, didn't work out very well with the ministry. So he began working in a furniture factory. He did not make a lot of money. Heidi and Jay, part of the Jack Hiles ministry, it was extremely fundamental. And what happens with fundamentalism is that there comes a deep isolation. It's built on an us and them paradigm. And so it's the notion that my beliefs are right and your beliefs are wrong. Mm-hmm. And in order for me to raise my family, I have to protect them from beliefs that are in what I would consider contrary to the word of God. So their family environment was very exclusionary. According to Leah, they had bought property out just outside of Morganton. It's a beautiful piece of land. There was a ranch house on it. Leah talked about, you know, having a wooded area. It's about an acre of woods to roam through. Not uncommon for a lot of kids growing up in those rural areas of Appalachia to talk about their, you know, connection to the land. Mm-hmm. And so what happened is they were not enrolled in school, that Heidi homeschooled them. Leah would say they would get their homework done or schoolwork done within the first couple of hours of the day. And the rest of the day, she and Luke roamed those woods, played outside, explored. They were just together all the time. They were only, I think, 18 months apart. They are what, you know, I would refer to as Irish twins. They even look quite a bit alike, both dark hair, dark-eyed, great smiles, very cherub-looking children. And she recalls those days fondly as being a great time of togetherness and family. But Leah was much more social than either her mother or her brother. And she felt the need to be with other people, to have connections and friendships outside of just the family. But that was not something that Heidi was open to. Heidi did not want her kids engaged in a broad way with other kids, particularly so for any kids who would not adhere to the kind of protective evangelical view that she and Jay had for their kids. So there was a lot of loneliness to that environment as well. Luke filled that loneliness with books. Leia filled that loneliness with the longing to be with friends, to have girlfriends. They were always very actively involved in the church. And the church they settled on was a church. It's still in operation. It's called New Manna. And it is about 40 miles, maybe 30 to 40 miles from their home there in Morganton. The church has a large Christian school. And eventually, when Leia's in high school and Luke is a senior, Heidi and Jay do enroll them in that private school.
You talk about that Christian school, the New Manna, and the strict adherence to the King James Version of the Bible. So they're very literal believers in this. But unfortunately, he gets busted for hacking into a teacher's computer.
Right.
And is expelled. So as a result, they're poor. And so scholarships are the way that he would be able to go to school. So no scholarships, no school. What does Heidi recommend that Luke do as a result?
As a result of that, I mean, Luke was brilliant, very smart, extremely well-read, but he needed the degree from New Manna in order to get into a college to begin with, because they weren't at that point accepting homeschooling degrees as viable degrees for college entrance. So that's why he was at New Manna to start with. But when he hacked into that computer, and I don't know, no one would say whether he hacked into the computer for porn reasons or whether he hacked into the computer to change grades.
Right.
I don't know the reason why he hacked into the computer, but he did get caught and he got expelled. And at that point, Heidi told him his only option was to join the military. Well, you're already in North Carolina. Your closest military base for that group was going to be the Marines at Camp Lejeune. So while Jay did not want his son to join the Marines, had no desire for Luke to do that because Jay had lost his father, a South Vietnamese soldier, to the war in Vietnam. He was opposed to it, and Leia was not included in on that decision, but Luke decided to do what his mother recommended and join the Marines. So you've taken a kid who has had this very isolating, very strict environment, and now you've put him at Camp Lejeune. I've been to Camp Lejeune. I don't know about you. I know a few Marines, Dan. I mean, it had to be quite the culture shock for Luke.
We have to talk about his friend, Casey Lee Byrums, complete opposite, as you write, of Luke. Yet they become friends while they're in the military. They get moved around various places. And Casey is a guy that had smoked pot and done other drugs. He has a reputation for doing some other drugs or has a history of doing other drugs. However, he's still smoking pot. But as a diametrically opposed opposite, Luke doesn't drink, cuss, do drugs, anything like that. He's a quiet guy, and Casey's a fun-loving, friendly guy. They decide to move in together, and he is married to a woman named Megan. I know when we're compressing this into a short period of time, but tell us the dynamics. What happens to put these people all together in one place?
So this group of people all end up at Camp Pendleton in Southern California. And it's Casey Byrums and his then wife, Megan, and Megan's best friend, Desiree. And California is an expensive place to live. Enlistees don't make that much money. Moving in together seemed like a good option for them because Megan and Casey were having financial troubles. Casey and Megan were all from the same town in Alabama, Coleman, Alabama, which is a great town. I've been to it many times. It's a fun-loving, very social, very hospitable community. Casey was the very first friend Luke ever had. And Casey made it his goal to introduce Luke to all the ways of the world. And he did.
Yes.
So it was with Casey that Luke started drinking. It was with Casey that Luke started smoking pot. It was with Casey that he and Desiree and Megan all started using the spice, which at that time was a drug that you could go down to the 7-Eleven and pick it up.
Right.
It was not considered in those days. It was not considered an illicit drug. The Marines didn't even test for it. But they began doing that. Desiree was born with diabetes, had been sickly most of her life. She had come to California just for the adventure to get out of Cullman, Alabama. But she had extreme diabetes and did not have health insurance. So the four of them devised a plan that Luke would marry Desiree. That would give him the ability to live off base, because if you weren't married, you didn't get to live off base.
Right.
So he could live off base and Desiree could have health insurance. Now, according to Desiree, they never consummated that marriage, that it was just a contractual marriage, period. It was not something that Luke had told his parents about. He had told Leah, but even Leah understood it to be a contract marriage. But it was understood by all involved that Luke had feelings for Desiree that Desiree did not have for Luke.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about Desiree not returning the affection or the interest or the love that Luke felt for Desiree, yet he posted on Facebook announcing the marriage, which she was enraged over because it was just a contractual marriage, not anything of any real desire. What happens, Casey Byrams? Tell us what happens to Casey and what is the effect on Luke?
So the process of all four of them living together, as you might imagine, young people doing illicit things, it didn't fare well. Megan got homesick for Coleman. She and Casey were fighting all the time. She eventually leaves Casey. Desiree and Luke have to move out to their own place. Casey spirals out of control when Megan leaves him. He's desperately in love with her, but not mature enough to handle marriage. And he had a long history of drug abuse that he could not seem to get over. We do know now, we didn't know it at the time, but we do know now that spice, especially the abuse of spice, can cause all kinds of psychotic problems for users. And so Casey goes back to Cullman because he's kicked out of the military for his drug use. He goes back to Cullman, but doesn't get in touch with Megan, who's moved back with her family. And he has an overdose, hooked up with his friends back in Cullman, and he ODs and dies. And Desiree and Luke are still living together. Luke still carrying a lot of the financial, although Desiree at this point has a job. But she is seeing other people. They're not divorced, but she is seeing other people and made it clear, you know, that she doesn't want a relationship of any romantic nature with Luke. Luke is still attracted to her. When she finds out through Facebook that Casey has OD'd, she calls Luke and tells Luke that she's crying, she's upset, that she's leaving, that she's going back to Cullman, that, you know, she's going to go be with Casey's mom and family and do what she can to help. And she invites Luke to go along with her, but then she never hears from Luke again. And Luke goes AWOL from the Marines, and he's told no one. It's like he's had some sort of mental break at that point. And he just disappears. He doesn't get in touch with his family. He doesn't get in touch with any friends. He writes a Facebook post about how much he loves Casey and how Casey turned him into a University of Alabama fan, and he signs it off, Roll Tide, and he disappears. He doesn't show up again until sometime later when he's found sleeping on benches in the Umatilla River there in Pendleton, and police get him for loitering, but he has no ID on him. So they don't know him as anyone other than Danny Wu. Danny Wu is the name he gives for himself. But we know now that what happened was, following Casey's death, Luke got on a bus and went as far as Pendleton, Oregon. He has told police that the reason he chose Pendleton was he ran out of money. But I believe that he stopped in Pendleton, Oregon, because he had left and gone AWOL from Camp Pendleton. I think the familiarity of the name is what drew him to the town.
Sounds like it. You talk about Amy Jane Branhagen, 19 years old, living on her own, worked at a travel lodge in Pendleton, cleaning rooms, didn't like the job at all. She is ambushed from behind and killed. The police have no idea. There's so many complications with the autopsy. They find drugs in her system, which is a surprise to everybody. But they also find that she has romantic or relationship connections with so many people. So very much like a police investigation, they have to start at family, boyfriends, friends, ex-boyfriends, and they have to follow every lead, whether it's good or whether it's bad. They have to make sure that this lead is not something to their advantage. So with this, it takes quite a bit of time to lead up to finding Luke and his responsibility for this. How does that happen?
The way it happens is that almost a year to the date after Amy Jane's murder, another woman is attacked on the Umatilla River walkway, again in daylight. Now the walkway has cameras on it. I know that walkway very well. I used to walk it quite a bit or run it with my children. It's a very popular area and well used. And a gal named Karen Lang, who I also knew, who Amy Jane had gone to church with. We had all gone to the same church, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. Karen Lang had told her husband she was going out for a walk. It was August, again, in 2013 this time. And she didn't return home from that walk. And so Dan, her husband, got worried. They called out a search party that evening, but it was getting on dark. They searched for hours in the dark and never found anything. Again, as soon as daylight rolled around the next morning, the police have started searching for her as well. And ball games are going on. It's summer morning. And so the walkway, again, is busy. But a police officer has gone, you know, it's a river walkway, so there's a lot of vegetation. He has gone over and around from a ballpark area on one part of the walkway where the cameras did not catch. And he's looking through that, and he hears something and looks in the brush, and he sees Karen Lang there. She is almost bled out. She had been beaten badly with a metal pipe. And so all of this evolves. And through cameras, they're able to see this guy that they know as Danny Wu exiting onto the walkway shortly after they had seen Karen Lang on the repeat video. And then they see him again exiting from the bathrooms. Looks like he had gone in and cleaned up and then come back out. Because he had had numerous contacts with the police over that year period, always as a loiter, always without ID, one time being jailed, but fingerprints weren't taken through some careless police work. One of the police officers who had previous contact with him recognized him, called him Danny Wu, which is actually a martial arts star. Mm-hmm. And so they put out an all points bulletin throughout Oregon, throughout the Pacific Northwest, in search of Danny Wu, who has disappeared once more. Karen Lang has been life flighted to the hospital at OHSU in Portland, where she's given a 1% chance of survival.
Now, they're looking for Danny Wu. How is it someone recognizes who Danny Wu is? How do they get him into custody?
He's gone for several days. They're, you know, searching for him. But people at the Roundup grounds, Pendleton's well known for its Pendleton Roundup, the largest Roundup rodeo outside of Calgary in the Northwest. So they have a lot of activity at the Roundup grounds, particularly in August and September, because the rodeo is in September. So the women who were working there started noticing food missing from the kitchen, and they in the employee's fridge. And one afternoon they walk in, and here's this Asian guy sitting in a chair eating from the employee fridge. They knew immediately who he was. Right. Of course, it frightened them. He just stood up very calmly and said, "Time to go." And he bolted out the door. They called the police in right away. The police brought in the dogs and the guns and a SWAT team, and they surrounded the Roundup grounds. And it was actually with a dog who had helped find Luke. He had been hiding up in the ceiling, you know, moving the ceiling tile, and had been living up in the ceiling of the Roundup ground facility and or the convention center facility. And they found him with one leg hanging out of that ceiling tile. And I think he was afraid. I think the officer told me he was afraid they would let the dog out on him. So he came down and he identified himself.
Now, he was taken to court and didn't have the luck that his grandfather had in sentencing,
no,
did he?
He did not have the luck his grandfather had. I know the judge who oversaw his case. And so Luke is now sitting at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. He is there for 40 years, which, again, you could argue still isn't long enough. Shouldn't he have life in prison for killing one woman and attempting and believed he had killed another woman? Mm-hmm. Certainly wanted to kill the other woman. Again, somebody he didn't even know. Unlike his father, grandfather, Luke had not sexually abused his victims. So there was that component that was totally different. And in his, you know, confession about it, Luke was proud of what he had done. And he admitted that, you know, he just felt compelled to kill.
Incredible. And so very much a good argument for the murder gene, that there is some connection DNA-wise.
I definitely believe, after researching, spending all this time and doing all of this research, I think that the more we find out about DNA, the more we all have to come to a belief that a lot of our decision making is not just based on our independent thought, like we prefer to believe,
right,
but a lot of what we do, the decisions we make, our behaviors have a lot to do with our DNA connections. We know, for instance, now that the trauma of slavery can be carried on, passed through those gene markers to offspring and their offspring and that offspring. So trauma that happens to you can be carried forward. You know, if you believe in the Bible, it's to your children's children. So we know that these things can be carried forward. We are seeing every single day the variety of health impacts that are inherited or shaped by our DNA markers. So, of course, it makes perfect sense that if we have violence in our history, that there's an inheritability factor toward violence.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Karen Spears Zacharias, for coming on and talking about The Murder Gene, a true story. For those that might want to take a look at this, is there a website for this book?
Yes. I mean, you can always order the book through your local favorite independent bookseller. It's available at Barnes & Noble and through Amazon, but you can also go to my website at KarenZack.com. You can find me on Facebook or LinkedIn.
Thank you so much, Karen Spears Zacharias, The Murder Gene, A True Story. Thank you so much for this interview and good night.
Thank you.